The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
Pat Carty of Hard Press is with me. You're a big fan.
I am a massive fan. I'd say I'm probably the biggest fan in the country.
No, how does one?
If I was doing what's called that thing? What's called that mastermind thing? If I was doing that in a specialist,
your specialist subject would be the Rolling Stones.
In fact, I'd say I know more about the Stones than I know about my parents, most of my friends, maybe even my kids.
And what particular era is it? Those early years?
It's all of it for me, but there is a segment of their career from May 1968 to about 72, 73, when they made four or five records, and they, without putting too fine a point on it, are the best records ever made by anybody.
How long was it from 62, when they first went into the recording studio, until they gained fame?
Well, they were making records in 63. You know, that demo that you're talking about there was, as you say, the Rolling Stones. And the reason for that, the apostrophe, is that when Brian Jones had to come up with a name for the band when they were playing in the Marquee, he happened to be standing near a Muddy Waters album that was called Rolling Stone. So that's where that comes from. And there's only Keith and Brian and Mick in the band at that time. It was Stu on Ian Stewart on the piano, who was soon demoted to road manager because the management said his face didn't fit in, and he'd a bit of
ouch.
He'd kind of one of those. Do you remember that fella that was on the ads in the 70s with the square face when he was shaving? He'd a bit of a face like that. And then there was another bloke called Tony Chapman on the drum. So Charlie Watts came in the next year, and then there's a demo in early 63 that came out a couple of years ago, and they already had it. It was only released officially a couple of years ago. Brilliant.
And what was it? Like, what was so unique about their music that was new in 1963?
Well, the thing that they were bringing in, and there was a few people at it, but they kind of got there first, is that they'd become obsessed with blues and rhythm and blues. So you're talking about Chuck Berry, you're talking about Muddy Waters, you're talking about Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, all these people. And it's not like today, or even when we were kids, where you go to a record shop and get these things. You had to search for these things. Mm. And they would send off to Chess Records in Chicago, and they'd send them the records. But they were the first kind of guys to get that. And, you know, the Beatles were already doing their thing up in Liverpool and then down in London. But this was a kind of a different thing.
And culturally, like, how soon did there kind of, was there established this divide between the Beatles fans and the Rolling Stones fans?
Well, I don't know if there was a big divide between the fans, you know. It's possible to like oysters and snails, Antoninus, you know what I mean? I think it was more in the press, really.
Okay.
And then, you know, there was headlines in the press like, would you let your daughter go with a Rolling Stone? Because they had longer hair and they looked dirtier. And then again, their management said, listen, well, the Beatles are all there in suits, so let's have the opposite of that. If people's parents like the Beatles, let's not have that. Let's have a band that your parents are going to hate.
So behind the scenes, were they any more hedonistic?
Well, you see, that's the thing. No social media at that time, so we don't really know what was going on with every day of the Beatles and every day.
Yes.
I wouldn't think so. No, I wouldn't have thought so. But they were all.
But they cultivated the image that they were more hedonistic.
But that's the thing, Richard. It's all records, you know, in the same way as it does now.
And were they pals?
They were, yeah, one of the early Rolling Stones singles, one of the first hits, was called I Want to Be Your Man, and that was written by John and Paul, and they gave it to the Stones. And what they did throughout the 60s, apparently, is that they would ring each other up, and they would say, have you a record coming out? We'll hold on for a couple of weeks. And then if you see, say, the video for All You Need Is Love by the Beatles, Mick and Keith are there doing backing vocals in the background. Brian Jones, I think, I don't know if that's true or not, but I think he plays sax on a Beatles B-side. So they were mates, you know. And
okay.
At the end of the 60s, there's the Rock and Roll Circus, the TV show the Stones did, and John Lennon forms a temporary band with Keith Richards. So, oh yeah, friends.
Stadium shows as well.
Yeah.
People know them so well now for their huge big stadium shows. I saw them in Slane a few years ago, whenever they played there, about 7 or 8 years ago, maybe.
Is it that long ago? Yeah.
They kind of helped establish that trend amongst the big bands, didn't they?
Yeah, I think they more or less invented it, to be honest with you. I think the first time they ever played, well, they played here in the 60s in the Adelphi, but the first big show here was Slane, not the first time, not the time
that's
we went.
That's not that, yeah, the first time.
For that. But the first time, and that tour was kind of the first, or one of the first big stadium tours, and they established that. They established the economics of it, made it pay, and that's when they started becoming super rich. You know, they were well off in the 70s, but it was in the 80s and the 90s when they became mega rich.
Because that's the other thing that's said about them, you know, is that when everybody has departed the stadium, Mick Jagger is still there kind of counting the gate receipts.
Well, that's the thing. I wrote an article one time and I said he never met a pound note he didn't like, and I think that's probably fair. But that's too, you know, that we shouldn't say that at the expense of his artistry, I don't think. I think he's underrated as a songwriter.
Yeah, but he was a savvy businessman. Oh, as well. It wasn't about being mean, but he was just he had real business acumen.
Well, the thing is, I mean, if you think about in the 70s when Keith Richards was busy getting arrested every other week, and it could have all fallen apart. But it was Mick who took over. They couldn't find him. They tried to find a manager when they broke out a manager and couldn't really find one. And Mick kind of took over. And he was in the London School of Economics when he was a young fella, and he's just. Someone told me a story once that they were on holiday, and they met this guy, and he was a financial advisor, and they're having a chat with him by the pool, and he said, "I've got to take this phone call." And he came back, and he says, "Yeah, that was Mick Jagger," and he says, "We do some work for him. He rings me every Friday at 3 o'clock in the dot just to see how everything's going."
Really? Yeah. Wow. Okay. Kept his finger on the pulse, absolutely, of the business. You mentioned the different members there who were there right from the off, or certainly within the first kind of 12, 18 yes. months, they had it settled. That's the other thing about the Stones, is the longevity and how long they were all together, pretty much the same makeup, you know, and there wasn't, there were not, there were.
Oh, there was a few substitutions.
Few, yeah. And yeah. a few little hiatuses, but no big long break, and then a kind of a reformation 15 years
down
the line.
There was a big fight in the 80s. Like after Dirty Work, which is about 83, 84, I think, or maybe even 85, they were fighting in the press. Mick and Keith were fighting in the press, weren't getting on. And they started making solo records and things like that. And then when they got back together then, that was the first time I got to see them, which was 1990, I think, in Wembley Stadium.
So there was a big long break.
They were fighting. And they call it now in interviews, they joke about it, World War III. Now, whether it was artistic reasons they got back together or whether it was, look at the amount of money we can make here, either one is good.
Yeah. Have you a favourite album?
I do, yeah. Exile on Main Street from 1972. I wrote 6,000 words about it this year in an article. And it's the greatest record ever made. There is no argument at all. I've heard an awful lot of records. That's the best one ever made. People can ring in if they like. But, you know, and with greatest respect to them, they'll be wrong.
All right. You can save your 30 cent, but if you want to spend it, 53106, let us know. Is Pat wrong? Is Exile on Main Street not the greatest album?
Record ever?
Oh,
it's
here
probably,
we go.
It's probably
he's doubling down, folks.
It's probably the pinnacle of all human achievement. You know, hold on a second now. Modern medicine is pretty impressive, and we went to the moon, allegedly, and that's all good, you know. But it doesn't rock like Exile on Main Street.
Pat Carthy of Hot Press. Pat, an absolute pleasure. We'll get the news headlines. Here's Eamon.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.